Welcome back. In this session, we're going to move beyond Saul, if you can imagine that, and get into the rest of the book of 1 Samuel. And so we want to make time. We want to move rather quickly. Part of what we do in a course like this is I like to compare it to archaeology, where sometimes you do an aerial survey of the terrain, and other times you land the plane and you get out and you do a surface survey and walk around on some things, and then occasionally you dig a trench. Well, we've been in a very deep trench with Saul, and now we're going to move on and maybe do a little more aerial work looking at the rest of 1 Samuel. We'll pause occasionally to glance at a significant feature or to highlight something. And mainly what I want to do is to get into this thematic survey that you see on your outline. I'll say a few words of introduction, but then we'll get into a thematic survey that I'll explain at the time. Now, I said I was getting away from Saul, and I have to begin by saying something about Saul, and that is that though Saul is no longer king after chapter 15 in God's eyes, that is, de jure, according to God's judgment, de facto, in point of fact, he remains on the throne for a considerable time, indeed probably a number of years. He is, however, no longer the center of attention from chapter 16 onward. David is the center of attention. David has not been absent in the preceding chapters, though he has not been named, but he has been described as the man after God's own heart, the man who pleases him, or as the neighbor who is better than you, Saul, we read in chapter 15. So the only place that Saul will really reappear as the main character is in chapter 28, but this just contributes to the picture of Saul's unfitness to be king, and thus it also contributes to the fact that it's right and good that David now become king. So it's typical to refer to this section beginning somewhere roughly in chapter 16, although those who like to divide the text are having trouble deciding where to divide it, to refer to this half of the book as the rise of David, or the history of David's rise. Some started in the beginning of chapter 15 so that you have a nice introduction of how Saul was rejected and then you get into the story of David. Others start at 16:1, others start at 16:14. I would suggest that probably we should take the book as a piece and not really worry about dividing it off, because whatever it may have been its existence at one point, it is now well integrated and tells one story. In terms of the theme of this portion of the book of Samuel, and indeed, in a sense, of the whole book, it is an apologetic. It's an apologetic for the rightness of David's rule. So you can see that in an early context, it would have served to justify the fact that though David was not the first king, he was the rightful king. And it would not have been unnecessary to have such an apologetic, such a document that would have defended David's right to rule. It would not have been unnecessary, even in the time of David, because there continued to be those who supported Saul. I need only remind you of, for instance, the man Shimei, whom we encounter in 2 Samuel 16. You're probably not quite there yet, but you'll soon read about Shimei. He was the man who went out and would throw dust at David when David was fleeing from his son Absalom. And he called David a man of blood, and he was clearly a supporter of Saul. And there would have been many Saulites still around, even though David was on the rise and then ultimately on the throne. And so it was important to defend to the people and to those who would read these documents why it is that David is on the throne instead of, say, Saul, or at least Jonathan, Saul's son. And this story accomplishes that. Now, the fact that it has an apologetic aim does not mean that it's not factual, that it's not historical. In fact, if it were not factual or historical or the right perspective on events, then it would be propaganda in a negative sense. Propaganda itself is a neutral term to propagate a particular view, and that can be right. But we tend to think of it as a negative kind of thing. And if it were disinformation, then it would be simple propaganda. But it's true information, and thus it does explain why it is that David is now on the throne. And at the beginning of, well, actually, I shouldn't say at the beginning, but throughout this section, it's made clear that David is not responsible for the death of Saul. He's not responsible for the death of Abner or of Saul's one surviving son after chapter 31 of 1 Samuel, Ishbosheth. In all of those regards, there are various episodes which demonstrate that David was innocent in his rise to power. Now, there are certain commentators who read between the lines differently, and actually I think they read into the spaces between the lines their own opinions that David was kind of a guerrilla warrior who would have done anything in his power to kill Saul, to be rid of Saul. In fact, the text tells us just the opposite. It was Saul who was out to get David, not David who was out to get Saul. I have 6 points that I could make about the defense of Saul and the defense of Abner and Ishbosheth. I'm going to skip over those in the interest of time, and I can give you that later if you'd like, in order to get into this thematic survey, because I really would like to get through this book tonight in the remaining less than half hour. So what I want to do in this thematic survey is to think beyond just the issue of content, more to the issue of message. Or what is the point? What is the application of some of these? And in order to do that, I would like to give titles, chapter by chapter. Now, these are not for you to take and use as your titles, but more thematic titles that describe in short fashion what I see to be at least one of the major points of application that we can discover in these chapters. And then I'll go in and talk a little bit about it. Now, if things are going well, this will probably spark all kinds of ideas in your mind, and they'll be great ideas and ideas that you'll want to share. However, in the interest of time, I'll probably keep ignoring hands for a while at least, unless I run out of steam, and then I may call on you. So don't be insulted or affronted if I don't call on you, and if I look at you and go, "Got it," you know, then don't bother to keep your hand up. It's very distracting. Okay? So we'll just march through this. Jot down your ideas as you have them. They will augment your notes, and maybe we'll have a chance to talk about them later. Now, first of all, as we get into chapter 16, you see the title I've given to chapter 16, 17, and 18. This is an overarching title. I'm going to give some more specific titles. But I've said, David's rise delights all but Saul. And really, everyone is delighted with David, or becomes delighted with David, but Saul. In these chapters, 16 to 18, we see that what really counts to God is not height, but heart. Just a way of recalling the difference between an impressive outside and an impressive inner life that God views as far more important. In chapter 16, we have the account of the anointing of David. And we have several sort of questions that automatically arise when we come to this chapter. One of them is the issue that arises when God tells Samuel to go and anoint the man whom he has chosen. And in verse 2, Samuel asks, "How can I go?" Remember, we talked about this a little bit. And the Lord says, "Well, take a heifer and say, I've come to sacrifice." Just to remind you, the issue is not so much that God is telling Samuel to lie, and we can defend it and say, well, it was true. I mean, he did come to sacrifice, but that's not why he came solely. I mean, that's not even the main reason he came. It is, in a sense, disinformation. But remember, I mentioned before, we have to allow for a certain irony, even in this text. In the preceding chapter, Saul has been defending his disobedience, saying, I know you told me to destroy all of the Amalekites and all of their livestock and everything, and I know we saved the best of their livestock because people wanted to save them, but I know we did that. But really, it was only to sacrifice. And my impression is that they're cooking up the best example, the best excuse they can on the spur of the moment. They really spared them because they liked them, and they wanted to benefit somehow from this great victory. And so they spared the best of the livestock, but they tried to excuse it, and Saul tried to excuse it. I said, well, it was only really to sacrifice. It was only for you anyway. And so it may be that when Samuel says, if Saul hears about this, what am I to tell him? He'll kill me. Oh, tell him you're going to sacrifice. Maybe God is giving Saul back a little bit of his own kind of rhetoric. Maybe there's some irony there. It's not a certainty, but maybe there is. The other thing that can be said in terms of that particular ethical issue is that it is not expected between enemies that truth is spoken, not in situations of warfare. It would not be right for an enemy to expect that you would be fully forthcoming with the truth any more than you would be fully forthcoming with what your next move is going to be in a chess match. Your opponent has no right to expect you to reveal your next move. So that can also be argued that now there is a breach between God and the rejected, unbelieving king. And there's no reason that Saul should expect that he will hear the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, now that he is rejected. Now, I know that raises a lot of ethical questions that we could go on at length about, but we don't have time, so I refer you to our ethicist, Dr. David Jones, who will clarify all remaining questions. He did? Oh, did he? Yeah, he probably did. That's how we all try to get by that way. Now, another question that comes up is in verses 13 and 14. And this has to do with the anointing of David by Samuel. And in verse 13 it says, "So Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him, David, in the presence of his brothers. And from that day on, the Spirit of the Lord came upon David in power." This is unusual. The Spirit of the Lord came upon Samson sporadically in power. But he comes upon David from that day forth. This is the first mention of this kind of permanent endowment with the Spirit. And the Spirit comes upon David in power. Now, the flip side we get in verse 14. "Now, the Spirit of the Lord had departed from Saul, and an evil spirit from the Lord tormented him." Now, that, again, raises a host of questions and causes furrowed brows in many quarters. I think there's, again, two ways to look at it. One is that the word evil does not necessarily mean wicked or morally reprehensible or morally evil, but it can mean simply troubling or calamitous or injurious. You know, God visits, sometimes He visits upon disobedient people, but even the world in general, evil circumstances, calamitous events. God can be the agent of bringing calamity upon an unrepentant people, maybe to bring them to their senses. Okay, that's one way to look at it, is to lessen the notion of an evil spirit, which we associate with a demon. You know, evil spirit, that's a demon. What's God doing sending demons to possess Saul? It could simply be an injurious, a calamitous spirit. It could have to do with his mental unraveling, with his growing insanity, and he does seem to become increasingly insane, without trying to be psychologist and psychoanalyze this situation. Another way to look at it is to say God is sovereign, and He is sovereign even over the agents of darkness. I mean, they don't. He is not there. He does not. He is not the author of evil, but certainly there is nothing that can take place that is outside His control that He cannot forbid, and thus He allows, as in the book of Job, for instance, He allowed the accuser to go and strike Job's property and then strike Job's body. And you could say, well, then God sent the accuser. Well, in a manner of speaking, yes. In simpler terms, He allowed that to happen. So maybe another way to look at it is to say, when God withdraws His Spirit, then of course what's left? You know, a calamitous spirit, an injurious spirit, and we're left to our own devices, and we do unravel. You know, God is the Father of all good things, the Father of lights, as James calls Him. So, in chapter 16, we have the anointing of David. We have also the induction of David into Saul's service. I mentioned earlier this as it were, letter of reference that we have in verse 18. I don't think we need to interpret that in such a way that we run into problems with the fact that David is still young in the succeeding episodes, and yet he's described here as a brave man and a warrior. Well, even as a young man, he has already killed a lion and a bear, and if that doesn't qualify you in a letter of reference as a warrior, you know, given the poetic license that we exercise with letters of reference, he's saying, you know, I can see this guy as a great warrior. You know, he'll be wonderful. I can see him as a CEO for your company. He's got what it takes. He's done it. I mean, he's already done it. He's young. So don't worry too much about that. Some people say, well, everything's dischronologized here and all of that. But this is a letter of reference. They're recommending him. Rushing on. We come to 17, chapter 17. I would entitle this chapter simply, The Key to Confidence. We have in this chapter David's demonstration in his confession, especially in verse 45. We have David responding to the taunts and the challenges of Goliath the Philistine when he says, You come against me with sword and spear and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. And, you know, armaments notwithstanding, you're going to go down. You know, I have my little sling, but the stone is God-directed, and nothing you bring against me is going to affect me. Now, make no mistake, the key to confidence is not the power of positive thinking. You know, here's the little guy. We talked about this at the beginning of the course. This is not, you know, the little engine who could. He said, you know, you're big and tough, but I believe in me. It's not that. It's, I believe in God. God has placed me here. God will defeat you, even though you look overpowering. So the key to confidence is placing one's trust where it belongs, not in ourselves, but in God. In chapter 18, oh, there's so many things in 17 to talk about. In chapter 18, maybe we'll do a course on Samuel someday. Can you imagine how much time Saul would get in that course? When we come to chapter 18, I would give this the title. And by the way, these are not zingy titles, all of them. They're just the best I can do at the time and trying to be descriptive. I would entitle 18, Holding Out When You Should Be Giving In. Holding out when you should be giving in. That is giving in to God. Saul is rejected, and Saul is not willing to accept that. And again, contrast the rejection of Eli. Remember when we talked about the rejection of Eli, we saw how he responded to his rejection in chapter 3, verse 18, by saying simply, He is the Lord. Let him do what is right in his own eyes. You know, such a phrase does not pass the lips of Saul. In fact, quite the contrary. In verse 8 of chapter 18, after Saul hears the people saying, Saul has slain his thousands, but David his 10,000s. Saul is very angry, and this refrain galled him. They have credited David with tens of thousands, he thought, but me with only thousands. What more can he get but the kingdom? Well, indeed. You know, you have been rejected. It was made perfectly clear when the robe was torn in chapter 15, Samuel said, This day the Lord has torn the kingdom from you and has given it to your neighbor who is better than you. Who might that be? David. Okay? Jonathan is a wonderful man of valor. He proved it in chapter 14. He is utterly absent in chapter 17. How do you explain that? A crisis of faith? I think Jonathan realized, My father's house is rejected. My hour, it will not come. It's not my time to step forward. Jonathan had the faith to face Goliath, but he's nowhere to be found. He's right here in chapter 18. It's not like he's gone on vacation. I think he rightfully withdrew and said, This is not our hour. It's not my time to take the lead. Let's see who that neighbor is to whom the kingdom is given. And Jonathan recognizes that it's David. And in fact, when David comes back from defeating Goliath, one thing that's really perplexed people in 1755 is the question. In fact, as David is going out, Saul watches David and he says to Abner, Abner, whose son is that young man? And Abner replies, As surely as you live, O king, I don't know. And the king says, Well, find out whose son this young man is. Why was Saul so agitated? Why was he so curious to find out? I mean, he'd already talked to David. But as he sees him going out there, I think Saul was already beginning to understand, you know, that's the guy. There's the man, the neighbor, who is better than I. I'm terrified of Goliath. This guy's going out to face him in the power of God, with faith in God, which I don't have. Who is this guy? And this business about who's his father's house and all. Remember, Saul had promised that the man who would defeat Goliath would be free in Israel. That means tax-free. Can you imagine that? Tax-free for your whole family. And also that he would become Saul's son-in-law. And so for various reasons, Saul suddenly becomes concerned. Who is this guy? Well, in chapter 18, we see Saul continuing to hold out when he should be giving in. And this will be a recurring feature of Saul's experience. Look ahead just a minute to chapter 20, verse 34. verse 30 and 31. Saul realizes that Jonathan has recognized in David the one who is to succeed him, and that's even been symbolized by Jonathan giving David his insignia, his weaponry, that which marked him out as crown prince. Jonathan has given that over to David, and they've made a covenant with one another. And Saul realizes this, and he's peeved, and he says in verse 30, Saul's anger flared up at Jonathan, and he said to him, "You son of a perverse and rebellious woman." I'll allow you to put that into modern idiom, as I think maybe the Living Bible does for you. "Don't I know that you have sided with the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of the mother who bore you? As long as the son of Jesse lives on earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established. Now send and bring him to me, for he must die." You hear that? Saul knows that David is the one to be king, but he won't stand for it. It's far from "he is the Lord, let him do what is right in his own eyes." He's holding out when he should be giving in. You know, we may find ourselves in positions where we have disqualified ourselves from some leadership role, and the last thing we should do is to compound sin upon sin by insisting on hanging on and sticking in when we should be submitting ourselves to God and getting out and allowing the next person whom God raises up to get in. Well, then we move on to chapter 19, and on your outline I have Saul seeks David's life. In these chapters, that's exactly what we find. In chapter 19, there's a very interesting recurrence of this proverb, this saying that we heard in chapter 10 when the bystanders ask, "What's happened to the son of Kish? Is even Saul among the prophets?" Well, in chapter 19, which I would entitle Acting in Character. What a boring title, but I'll tell you why. In this chapter, Saul is now bent on killing David. That is his intent. And he knows where David is. David is with Samuel. And Saul sends emissaries to go take David in order to kill him. But the emissaries, when they arrive, they keep falling in with this worship service that is in progress, and they prophesy there with the prophets. And Saul gets frustrated, and so he heads out to do the deed himself. And while he is on his way, notice in verse... in verse 23, it says, "So Saul went to Naioth at Ramah, but the Spirit of God came even upon him, and he walked along prophesying until he came to Naioth." It wasn't mob psychology. He wasn't there yet. The Spirit of God comes upon him and does that work again. He changes him into a different person. The person who is the real Saul was out to kill David. God changes him into a different person, and he strips off his robes and also prophesies in Samuel's presence, and he lays that way all that day and night. This is why the people say, "Is even Saul among the prophets?" And it's with greater irony that they say, "Yeah, right," when God overpowers him and against his will causes him to act out of character. But appearances can be deceiving. Okay, again, we've talked about that. So, we rush on. Chapter 20. Chapter 20, I would call "The High Cost of Holding Out Against God, Part 2. Okay, we've had that in chapter 18. Saul is still doing it in chapter 20. And this begins to result in further alienation of Saul from those who would support him. Jonathan in particular recognizes that David is being done an injustice by his father. And so in verse 34, Jonathan got up from the table in fierce anger. On the second day of the month, he did not eat because he was grieved at his father's shameful treatment of David. There's something about persisting in sin that begins to alienate us, even from those who love us, even from those who would support us. And Saul is in his unwillingness to submit to God's judgment and God's disqualification in his own life, is beginning to alienate himself, even from a dutiful son, even from a son who doesn't wish him ill, but when push comes to shove, if Saul is going to go that way, Jonathan has to side with David. And that's a high cost. There's a progressive alienation we see until the point that even Saul's men have a hard time going along with what Saul asks them to do. Chapter 21. This is the account of David at Nob as he goes to Ahimelech, and Ahimelech asks him what he's up to, and he says he's on a mission from Saul and so forth. and really deceives Ahimelech. I've entitled this Half-Truths That Hurt Others. I think one of the things we learn from this chapter is that even David, even King David, was a human being whose every action was not right. We will see later that David will admit as much, that he was wrong to do what he does here. He deceives Ahimelech, perhaps in an effort to not have him be complicitous in David's escape, perhaps to shield Ahimelech from later danger, but the effect is actually the reverse. Maybe if he had been straightforward with Ahimelech, Ahimelech could have said, okay, well, now I need to choose sides. Who am I with? If I help David, I better help David and hit the hills, you know, get out of here because I'll be in big trouble. Well, chapter 22 follows up immediately, and I've entitled this one, The Depravity of Man Without God. Here Saul is in action. He comes to the priests at Nob, over whom Ahimelech was the high priest, and he slaughters the priests at Nob. Notice the phrase, let's see where it is, down in verse 19. He also put to the sword Nob, the town of the priests, with its men and women, its children and infants, and its cattle, donkeys, and sheep. Have you heard a phrase like that before? Where? Okay, but where in the Saul account? He was told to do that to the Amalekites. Chapter 15, verse 3 at the end. Do not spare them, put to death men and women, children and infants, cattle and sheep, camels and donkeys. Verbatim repetition except for the mention of camels. The Amalekites had them, the priests of Nob didn't. So in the interest of truthfulness, the camels are not mentioned. But apart from that, the lists are identical. And what we see is, here's the depravity of a man without God who did not kill those who were the enemies of God, whom he was sent to kill, and ends up killing the priests of God. It's a dangerous thing to step outside the will of God. No telling what we may find ourselves doing. We can't imagine what we're capable of outside his will. Saul's officials in verse 17 of chapter 22 appear even more righteous than he. It says in 17b, but the king's officials were not willing to raise a hand to strike the priests of the Lord. Saul was. His own officials wouldn't do it. He had to choose Doeg the foreigner, the Edomite, to begin the process, and he was willing. Now, also at the end of chapter 22, when the one sole surviving priest of Nob, now these were the descendants of Eli, so this was the fulfillment also of the rejection of the house of Eli and the fact that this was coming to them for their sin. But when Abiathar gets to David, David says in verse 22, then David said to Abiathar, that day when Doeg the Edomite was there, I knew he would be sure to tell Saul, I am responsible for the death of your family, your father's whole family. Stay with me. Don't be afraid. The man who is seeking your life is seeking mine also. You will be safe with me. So David there admits that he is responsible for the death of Abiathar's family. Now there's a great complex of events. Eli's sin, the rejection of the house of Eli, God's pronouncement of judgment on the house of Eli, Saul's sin, Saul's wickedness in doing what even was within the will of God, just as those who crucified Christ were wicked for doing so. And yet God was accomplishing his will through that sacrificial death and so forth. Now, moving on, chapter 23 deals with David's continued flight from Saul. In a general sense, you might entitle 23, 24, 25, and 26. I really kind of grouped them all together, and so I'll throw a title out for all of them. And that's simply this: adversity, leave it in God's hands. Adversity, leave it in God's hands. Well, first of all, chapter 23 sort of gets us started by describing the way in which, or maybe I could give another title to 23. I could call 23 True Friendship, because it really highlights what friendship is all about. Notice in verse 15 and following that David is at Horesh. He's been betrayed by a city that he just rescued. But when Saul hears where he is, David inquires of God and says, will these people turn me over to Saul? And they say, yeah. Even though he had just rescued them, So he learns a little bit about false friendship, but then he's visited by his true friend, Jonathan. Saul's son, Jonathan, in verse 16, went to David at Horesh and helped him find strength in God. You know, that I think is a good motto for friendship. You know, a good friend doesn't deny the truth of the situation, doesn't deny the realities. If you are suffering it with a very severe illness, perhaps an illness that's terminal, your true friend doesn't keep telling you it's not terminal. Your true friend acknowledges the real situation, but the true friend helps you find strength in God. And that's what Jonathan did for him. We don't know exactly how all he did that. He said, "Don't be afraid. My father Saul will not lay a hand on you," which was true because God was protecting David. "You will be king over Israel, and I will be second to you." Now, that's not true because Jonathan was dead by the time David became king. But if what he is saying is, "I will take second place," then that was true. He was already doing that. Okay, so a true friend helps the other find strength in God. Chapters 24, 25, and 26 have the overarching title, "David Protects Saul's Life and Avoids Blood Guilt." Twice in chapter 23, in chapter 24, and also in chapter 26, David does just that. He protects Saul's life when he had golden opportunities to take his life. In the cave, he was close enough to him to carve off part of his robe. And remember, his conscience smote him because of the symbolic significance of robes. You know, it's like he was carving off part of the kingdom, I think. I think that's why his conscience smote him. But in real terms, he didn't grasp the kingdom, but he regretted even a symbolic act of aggression like that. But he used it to show Saul, you know, "I could have killed you, but I didn't." And then in chapter 26, David also had an opportunity to kill Saul when he was slumbering in the camp, and he was even encouraged to do so by his men. But he took Saul's spear and his water jug and took it up to a far hill and said, "Who are you coming out against, a partridge?" Which the Hebrew word is a caller, and he was calling to him from the hill. He said, "Are you coming out after a caller? You know, here I am calling. Look what I've got." And he kind of chastises Abner, for not protecting Saul. But he didn't take his life. Now, in chapter 25, the question is, why is that there, the story about Nabal? Again, I think I've alluded to this. Chapter 25 is there because Nabal is vulnerable. Nabal is not the Lord's anointed, and David has been avoiding taking up arms against Saul or killing Saul because Saul is still the Lord's anointed, though rejected. He's still kind of set apart by God, and David's not going to touch him. Nabal, however, is a different story. And so in chapter 25, David learns that very important lesson that God will deal with his adversaries. David is waylaid by the wise Abigail and prevented from taking matters into his own hands. And so he is forestalled, and he praises God that God sent this wise woman to stop him from doing what he otherwise would have done. He was ready to deal with Nabal and all his male offspring so that not a one of them would have been living the next day. And instead, the next day, as I mentioned earlier when we were talking about word plays and such, Abigail goes back to tell her husband what almost happened and finds him celebrating in a banquet like the banquet of a king. And there are many ways in which Nabal, whose name means fool, seems to be sort of a surrogate Saul. He sort of represents Saul in this chapter. She goes back to tell him what nearly happened, but he was so inebriated, she thought, well, I might as well wait until the morning when he's sober. And the text tells us when the wine had gone out of Nabal, and again the word Nabal also sounds like the wineskin, when it had gone out of the old wineskin and he was sober, she told him what almost happened, and the sober facts caused his system to seize up. We don't know medically exactly what happened, but 10 days later he died. It says his heart became a stone. He probably had a heart attack, and his heart became a stone, and later he died. And David learned, God will defend me. God will deal with my enemies. Now, I can see from the clock, I'm not going to make it to the end of 1 Samuel today, but maybe we should end with that note. You know, in life, we are all going to be confronted from time to time with those who are against us for whatever reason. We're going to be confronted with adversaries. The best defense is not a good offense. You know, the best defense is not do unto them before they do unto you. And it's often best not even to defend yourself, but to allow God to defend you. I'm not saying you should never speak the truth in love, but I'm saying don't become personally defensive. It's far better to turn the other cheek and thus entrust your well-being to one who is far better able to manage your affairs and to deal with your adversaries than you are. That's what David learned, and that's what we can learn from it. We will finish 1 Samuel after the midterm, after the fall break, which is next week. The following week, we'll finish 1 Samuel and march on through 2 Samuel. Thank you for your patience.